10th, 1974.
Can we start by asking you some of the questions that we generally ask?
Yeah, sure.
And looking back over that period to 1948, what major political changes have you seen in this state or in the South?
You mean since 48?
Yeah.
Well, I'd have to talk almost entirely about Louisiana to have any pretension of expertness on it. In the 1940s and up into the 1950s, in this state, people, you know, when they talked about their political affiliation, they said, I'm a long or I'm an anti-long. Sort of like they belonged to two clams. But really it was a political nomenclature, and if you were long, you meant you were for all social services, high-income corporation, taxation, what might be generally called the liberal side. And if you were an anti-long, you meant you were what would generally be called the conservative side. And as I see it, that division survived until the late 1950s or around 1960. But beginning in the late 1950s, when the integration issue began, as the slavery issue did a century or more before, to absorb all other issues. And since 1960, as I see it, there is no clear-cut division within the Democratic Party in this state. Of course, they're, you know, they're conservative Democrats and liberal Democrats, using the terms very generally. But I don't think they're as clearly defined or differentiated as they were before. Of course, since about the middle of the 1960s, you have this almost miraculous turnaround I describe in this article, you know, when the legal segregation was finally destroyed. And it, since that time, is a very, very minor issue in politics or even in political thinking. I mean, nobody's going to run anymore on an attitude of saving the whites from the niggers. That's just impossible. Nobody would even think of it. Since the ending of legal segregation, thank God, it's much more possible now for white Southerners, certainly, to think of normal, what I'd call normal political issues, economic issues.
But
instead of yelling about niggers all the time, God, that's all they ever used to talk about, you know. And, it was the one issue. And beginning in the 50s and in the early 60s, it absorbed all other issues. The guy who screamed loudest was elected. Everybody was for segregation, but the guy who yelled loudest was likely to make it. Now, not all. It was Willie Reinach didn't make it in this state. He screamed louder than everybody else, but he didn't make it. But in other states, the loudest screamer did. Everybody was for it, but the guy who was most extreme in his rhetoric was the guy who would win the election. That was when Bill Winter got beat in Mississippi. He was for segregation, but he didn't emphasize it. His opponent beat him.
But before that issue absorbed all others, was essentially, you can say it was long anti-long, was it kind of populist, anti-populist, or didn't it break down that way? Didn't it break down in economic terms?
Well, yeah, it was, I think, an economic division. You know, you said you were wanted to see the program of social welfare kept and extended. You favored a lot of the tax burden falling on the corporations instead of the little guy. Well, I don't think of other issues now, but as I see it, it was largely an economic differentiation. Yeah, and well, I mean, you know, if you were along, you believed the people should rule and all that kind of jazz that Huey and Earl had taught them. But
where is it now? Are we going back to that sort of division?
Well, no, that's the thing that puzzles me. I'm not sure that we've gone back to it where it was as sharply defined as it was before. I wouldn't know how to classify Edwin Evans ideologically. Or John McKiffin. John McKiffin considered himself a a long out, an Arab Earl long, a Huey long. But I don't know that McKiffin had a definite political philosophy or ideology or even something less than that. I rather doubt that he did. If he did, he never expressed it. And I couldn't classify Edwin Edwards. I guess you'd say he's a contemporary Southern liberal. I don't know. I don't know how much Edwin Edwards wants to change society.
Insofar as race taking over the immigration issue during the late 50s, did it really predominate in Louisiana beyond that one governor's race, Jimmy Davis term?
Yeah, well, you see, it starts in the late 1950s, really. And say when Earl Long was in his last term, it's when the legislature was beginning to consider measures to prevent it. And at that time, the Civil Liberties Union circulated a petition which simply prayed the legislature not to close the public schools. And it was a petition that a segregationist could well have signed if he didn't want to abolish the public schools. And, oh, there were about 56 or so professors, among others, who signed it. And all the reaction of the legislature was rabid. General Middleton was then president. The deans had to go down and appear before the Reinach States Rights Segregation Committee, whatever it was called, to deny that these professors were communists or communist inspired or were nigger lovers. Actually, some was thought at that time the legislature might abolish the university. I think now, you know, it was very far fetched, but we feared. And then you get it when Jimmy Davis elected governor, and then you get the school integration in New Orleans, and he makes no attempt to restrain the legislature, which I think Earl or somebody like him might have done. And it really comes to this very ugly height during the Jimmy Davis administration. And I think he is very much to be criticized there for not trying to hold that in line better than he did. I mean, a southern governor could have great deal of influence on what the legislature did. And Jimmy Davis, let them have their heads.
How'd you assess McKiffin's role in that?
Well, McKiffin was elected over Shep Morrison. Of course, Shep was a segregationist too, as he said openly. Shep said, we got to use the rule of reason, whatever that meant. I think Shep, incidentally, was a very weak man. I don't have much admiration for Shep. But McKiffin just murdered him in the campaign, and McKiffin accused him, of snuggling up to the people in Washington. And then McKiffin got in. He followed a very restrained course on the racial issue, and probably could do it more safely than Morrison could have, because he was known as a segregationist, you see, a North Louisiana segregationist. And yet, actually, once he got in power, he does not inflame the racial issue. In fact, he plays it down. And he could get away with it, as I say, more easily, I think, than Shep Morrison could have. But, he just murdered Shep in the campaign, got Shep on the defensive. Shep made the mistake of answering every charge McKiffin leveled at him, including the one that he had a toupee, I mean, you don't answer all these attacks. You go to the attack yourself. Shep got up on television and pulled his hair. Thin locks, he said, see, my hair is real. You can come up and pull it if you want to. Well, ridiculous, I don't think that... I think McKiffin just talked that way to get elected and then acted as he thought he had to when he was governor.
When the term reform candidate is used in Louisiana, what does that mean?
Well, it used to mean somebody who wanted good government, which often meant government by the elite, I think. I mean, that was the way it was in the long period, as I read it. I'm very suspicious of the real reform instincts of the anti-Longs, at least during Huey's period and Earl's period, too. Well, some of them were. Some of them would have were sincere and deserved the title, but I think a lot of them, when they talked, they just wanted to get the longs out. But that's what they meant, you know, economical government, good government, gentlemen in power, end of the long kind of graft, and maybe a more polite kind of graft.
Has there been any element of a genuine reform movement in Louisiana for the long economic tradition, but with, say, honesty in government?
You mean with a liberal economic orientation and then for honest government, huh?
Right.
Well, you see, one problem there is you can't have what they mean by honest economical government if you're going to have economic reform. Economic reforms cost money. You can't have a low budget with a liberal populist coalition. Now, you may have no corruption in government or little corruption in government, but with any kind of a liberal coalition group, it would necessarily, as I see it, involve a big state budget, big state expenditures, in order to satisfy their constituents. But, he always talked about honest government within his framework, so did Earl, but people in Louisiana don't take this too seriously. People in Louisiana, you know, I wasn't born here, but I have the same psychology, have an ambivalent attitude toward corruption. You know, on one hand we deplore it, on the other hand we brag about it.
Yeah, I think
we got the best. We got the best.
Quote from you, I think Louisiana admits corruption and takes pride in it.
I'm outside and people start bragging about their corruption. I say, listen, you ain't got nothing compared to what we got down in Louisiana. You know. Ours is always funnier, too.
But has that attitude changed at all?
You know, I don't know whether it has or not. I doubt it. Now, some people, of course, want it to change, and I mean, you know, particularly I've heard Dean Ross over in Business Administration say, you know, it hurts the state in getting business if there's this image of the state. And I don't know that it's changed. Curiously, I got a speech I give on Huey Long. I call Huey Long and the Problem of Our Time, and I've given that a lot of campuses. And part of it, partly for information, partly for interest, I describe the corruption down here. And in Louisiana, you get loud, appreciative laughter. And this is pretty much true, too, of other southern campuses where I've been. But God in the North, they're grim as hell about this. They're shocked when I describe these episodes, you know, that I think are howlingly funny, among other things. But Louisiana audiences and practically all the southern campus audiences I've talked to have also, you know, laughed knowingly, but not in the North.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Have you?
No, I tell you what it is. In part what I say in here, the problem of our time is, can you accomplish important change within the democratic framework? And Huey Long thought you couldn't. So he kept the forms of democracy, but subverted it. In other words, he thought you couldn't bring change within the system. But instead of destroying the system, he kept it and manipulated it. But that's what I mean by the problem of our time, which is a very important question, really. See, can you bring important change within the democratic framework?
Could you also say in here that Lyndon Johnson felt you could?
He felt you could, yeah. Yeah.
I've been told that Hale Boggs was the leader of the, quote, reform movement in Louisiana back from the time when he was in law school and he and a group in the late 30s.
Well, now, reform, you mean in honest, efficient government? Is that what you mean?
Non-corrupt government, I suppose.
I don't know. I've never heard him characterized that way, but it could be. I don't think so.
Is it still realistic to characterize people as long and anti-long and use that as a way to explain what happens in elections?
No, I don't think so.
When did that change?
In fact, since about 1960, people say, is there a long machine anymore in Louisiana? And I don't think there is. I think it was a personal creation of Huey Long and Earl Long. It depended largely on them.
Well, McKesson picked up some remnants of it, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that was probably the end of it.
Well, he went around the state and talked to a lot of the old Long leaders before Gillis got to him, and got them on his side. And so when Gillis started, therefore, when he in a particular town, Gillis would often have to pick up a younger man, because McKesson had got to the original old Long leader first and got him committed. But I don't know if you want to call that a machine, but I don't think McKesson recreated the old Long machine.
But are there people still identified as being part of the Long tradition or machine or fraternity, whatever you want to call it today, that you put on a tab?
Oh, yeah, you could pick Ernest Clements over at Oberlin, who's on the Public Service Commission. Do you identify him? And Ernest is, well, you ever heard him speak, it's almost like Earl Long speaking, only his voice is better, but same, you know. Ernest considers himself an enemy of the corporations, a friend of the people, except he don't like niggers. I mean, you get him on some of these new contemporary issues. And, you know, this is a surprising thing to me. Actually, I suspect that at Huey's time, and for a while in Earl's time, a lot of the old Long people were actually more tolerant or humane on the racial issue than they were later. Or that their descendants were, maybe their sons. Curious thing that on the racial issue, in an older time, of course, when the pressure was less intense, people could take a more enlightened or humane attitude than people could later. Somebody did an article on an old populist sheriff in Texas in the 90s who had supported Negro voters, and he supported the right of the Negroes to vote. Limited rights for them, but still something at that time. And eventually, as I remember, got shot up about it. The fight between the Negroes and the whites. And the person who did this article interviewed his daughter or his granddaughter. And this gal wasn't nearly as liberal on the racial issue as this old boy had been back in the 1890s.
So the basic political change then occurs at the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s.
I think so, yeah.
It's really the breakdown of this whole Long, anti-Long.
Yeah.
Was there any other...
No, you know, it could appear again. I don't know. But nobody is going to, propose the ending of these reforms, the economic changes that the Longs fought for. Nobody's going to want to abolish those. What would the division be all about, you see?
Well, has the Long legacy in Louisiana been that in contemporary Louisiana politics, that insofar as statewide races, basically liberal candidates are going to win by Southern tradition?
Well, the Longs, Huey Long, Earl Long, you just cut the racial issue off. It wasn't even a part of it, you see. I mean, if you did anything for Negroes, it had to be done on the quietly, on the side, which Earl Long, I think when Earl Long was governor, about Negroes comprised about 15% of the total vote in this state. And this is before the federal pressure. And this was largely because of Earl Long's efforts that a lot of them got on the ballot in certain parishes. But, I mean, this was something you didn't talk about. In campaigns, you talked about these other areas, public works, welfare and all this kind of thing. Increased pensions, maybe, or whatever the case might be. But as I say it, in the 40s and the 50s, this was the way the factions divided. The race issue, you didn't discuss it publicly. Both Huey and Earl realized that you couldn't help just some poor people and another. You had to cut the Negroes in on it, but this was something you didn't go out and advertise if you could help it.
But my point is that the last governor's race, the three high candidates were all basically, by contemporary Southern standards, would be considered liberal Democrats. moderate to progressive.
Well, you mean Gillis and Bennett Johnston and Edwards?
Yeah.
Well, why would you classify Bennett Johnston as a liberal? I don't think I would. I mean, I said I didn't know what kind of, whether Edwin Edwards has a clear-cut set of political beliefs, and I'm not sure Bennett Johnston does either. He couldn't be too liberal in Caddo Parish and get elected.
But he projected himself as basically a moderate to progressive type candidate, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, first I got kind of a prejudice against J. Bennett Johnston. I think he's a non-hero. And product of the television age, low-key, quiet, cultured. He's a nice guy. I think he's a weak man. I don't see him as a strong man. And I wouldn't have thought of him as a liberal. Incidentally, you'd have to pursue this to get verification for it. But I know it's true. Do you know who Father A.K. McKnight is? In Lafayette, he's a black, and he's a leader of the Southern Black Cooperative Movement. And I say I wouldn't want you to quote me on this, because I don't know whether he'd want it quoted without his verification of it. But he called one of my students who did a paper on it. They deliberately divided their vote and gave some of it to Edwards and some of it to Johnston. Well, I don't know whether they divided between Gillis and Edwards. Anyway, they gave some of the vote to Johnston. So if he got in the second primary, he couldn't yell block vote. But I wouldn't think of Bennett Johnston as a howling liberal, exactly.
There might be another they might coalesce again around another Wong-type person in the future. You say you don't write that off as a possibility.
No, but Huey Long comes at a particular time when for decades government has done practically nothing for the masses of the people. And Huey Long says government should, and government does, and he establishes that tradition. Government, one of the purposes which government exists is to perform social services, and Earl Long enlarges that, you see. But how do you enlarge it any farther without making some great drastic change in the system? How do you go beyond that, you see? I mean, a Long type leader of what would he propose? Higher welfare, higher pension?
Probably get into health delivery.
What?
Health delivery.
Maybe. But Huey Long capitalized on widespread discontent and did something about it, and Earl Long filled it in. But I wouldn't see another Long type leader coming along to rouse the masses unless there was some, you know, widespread economic dislocation, which were a lot of people discontented and would then turn to a leader who would promise to help them.
But you don't see that on the horizon?
No, I don't. In fact, if in the South or in the nation, if there'd been during the 60s, if there'd been a mass leader who would have risen, it would have been from the right. Somebody like George Wallace would have said, I will save you from disorder. I mean, I think if the disorders of the 60s had continued, there would have been a leader from the right who would have appeared. Because, you know, if the only choice people have is between order and something else, they'll take order if that's the only choice. Most people will take order.
Well, was the Edwards tax package, the recent one, taking off the sales tax on food and drug and putting more on the oil, Wasn't that in the long tradition?
Yes, it was. Yep, yep. Now, it's also because the governor would like to get money, of course, and he seized on this energy crisis, I think, very adeptly, and said, look here, we this is going to help the state in the energy crisis. And ordinarily, he'd had a hell of a time getting those bills. So, damn hard to raise taxes in this state with this two-thirds rule. He would have had a hell of a time. It's a shackling thing. It's terrible.
He didn't mention that.
Now, that was put in by the anti-laws.
Right, I'm familiar with that.
That was put in by the anti-laws to prevent Earl from raising taxes.
Can you think of any other major political changes in the last 25 years?
Well, you mean in Louisiana? No, I don't, unless you can suggest something to me. I mean, what I told you is the as I see it, the important thing. It's the end of an era, too, see, with 1960, the death of Earl Long. You're never going to have people like that again in politics. You can't with television.
So television is a major change, as you see?
Yeah.
From
television's a
major. In terms of campaign style.
Yeah. I mean, you can't get up and yell and holler like Earl Long did, and you have to get on television. You can do it on the stump, but maybe we've entered the age of the non-hero. You know, you've like J. Bennett Johnson may be the perfect epitome of it. You know what? You see what? You know what I mean by the non-hero?
The point I was making before, though, is that the long tradition resulted in Louisiana in whites, basically poor whites, voting for economic liberals and electing them.
Yeah.
And now blacks, most of whom are poor, are voting, and therefore are naturally going to be voting for economic liberals.
Yeah.
And so is the permanent legacy of the longs that Louisiana is going to retain a basically economically liberal form of government.
Yeah,
but now
you know it doesn't work as neatly though as all that. Now, '64, Gillis carried two of the Negro wards in New Orleans, then he lost others. He didn't get the Negro vote in New Orleans he thought he was going to get, and came out of there with a very narrow lead. And then in other parts of the state, this Negro candidate Bell, was it, in some of the little smaller towns, outpulled Gillis. But I don't know why at least one ward heavily populated by blacks didn't go for Gillis. Why? Were they bought up or were they intrigued by something else? I don't know.
Who did they go for?
I don't remember now, but I know that Gillis got part of the black vote, but not what he expected he was going to get. But I don't know who got the other part. I don't remember now.
Does that suggest that maybe down the road there might be a coalition of blacks and, say, poor whites? Or is the race issue still that high?
Well, some commentators have said that, in effect, that was the kind of coalition that elected Edwards.
Now, my question is, that the coalition that now dominates in this state?
What?
Is that the coalition that now dominates in the Democratic Party in this state?
Coalition of Negroes and whites that elected Edwards. Now, I don't know how you would break up the white vote economically or socially. What classes he appealed to? Do you know? I mean, could you demonstrate where Edwards got his biggest blocks of white votes? I don't know. But what was? One importance of the Negro vote was it enabled him to counteract this normally big white vote against a liberal candidate or a moderate candidate in North Louisiana, because so many of the blacks up there voted for him. And now, I remember 1960, when Jimmy Davis ran against Morrison in the second primary, and just for fun, I checked the votes of some of the northern and southern parishes. And the southern parish, Morrison would carry it maybe 5-3. And then you'd go into the north where the population was scantier, practically all white voters then, was scantier, but where in a second primary you'd really get a block vote. Talk about block votes. And I think it was Union Parish or Lincoln Parish, maybe both, I don't know. Morrison lost them 5-1 to Davis. And you'd get, a population of a parish with a relatively small population like Union. Nevertheless, by delivering a 5-1 vote for Jimmy Davis, it would wipe out Shep's majority in a more populous southern parish. But Edwards was able to counteract that to some degree. I mean, partially because of the Negro vote this time.
Has there, in fact, been a change in from domination by North Louisiana to domination by South Louisiana in state politics?
Well, that was, this was certainly the case in the last election, yeah. About South Louisiana, well, now, I don't know, I haven't examined the, you know, the vote breakdown enough to see, but I don't know whether the South Louisiana parishes, I know some of them did, went very solidly for the South Louisiana candidate, which they didn't used to do. He might carry them, but not by a big enough majority to counteract the North. But I think Edwards did carry them, didn't he, most of the Southern?
Yeah,
by
Edwards made a direct open appeal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cajuns should support Cajun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he made a very direct, apparently the most direct ethnic deal made in a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this was a real turnaround in the last election of South Louisiana, Catholic, Jesus, supported by blacks.
Do you see any political realignment in this state? What kind of future do the Republicans have? And to add to that question, do you agree with the position expressed by some that the Republican problem is that they really still are old-time Republicans who want to divide the spoils, or another view that the basic problem has just been a lack of effective leadership?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, and of course, something influences voters, at least of an older generation, just habit, you know, you're in the habit of voting one way. But I don't see any prospect of a Republican upswing in some campaign, a very attractive Republican candidate for governor. Particularly if the Democratic candidate was not attractive or had been smeared or something, might win. In fact, some people thought, and I half swallowed it, that Treen, you know, might win. That the other disgruntled Democrats would gang up behind him. But even if he got elected, so what? What could he do? You know, only a very few members of the legislature. Actually, the Republican Party, you know, what's it going to be as compared to the conservative Democrats? It's no different. God, when Charlton Lyons ran against Joe Wagner for Congress from the Northeast District, the question, which one was the more conservative? Wasn't conservative liberal, which of these two candidates was the more conservative? I don't think they mark themselves out a distinct position in politics. You know, what do they stand for, after all? What are they going to do if they win? What's their philosophy of government and economics? They don't come over, I think.
How do you assess the administrations since 1948 in this state? Obviously, McKithen had two of them, but if you look at all of them, which ones have made the most changes or progress, or however you want to measure, the most significant for the state?
Well, I think I would have to say Earl Long. Of course, I was along. Politics, but I admired Earl. I thought Earl was all right, a good man. Have you interviewed Bob Cannon, by the way?
No.
He's on the bill.
Yeah, he'd be glad to talk.
Kiffin Saturday.
You
know,
yeah. Bob would tell you he's a reform candidate. And Bob, I think, as far as I know, is an honest man. honest conservative, he tells you he's a Jeffersonian. And I think he probably means it. Not in the pure Jeffersonian sense of the 18th century, but Bob was a Jeffersonian. But, I don't think Bob as governor did any great harm to the state, and I don't know ever that he did any great good either. But I would say since the war, Earl Long probably has been the most forward-looking administration, according to my prejudiced viewpoints. I'd say Jimmy Davis is one of the worst.
Was there anything notable in his administration other than his role on the race issue?
You mean Jimmy Davis? I think you'd find it hard to classify Jimmy Davis, you know, Long, anti-Long, liberal, conservative, what is he, you know? He's not that firm.
What did Earl Long do that stands out in your mind?
Without going into detail, of course, Earl always was for higher taxes and higher expenditures, roads, welfare, education, and when he was governor, somebody said Earl Long probably had never read Machiavelli, but he instinctively practiced him, and Earl immediately got a big tax bill through right away. And this aroused cries of anguish, a lot of people opposed, but he had the money. And then for 3 years, he spread out the expenditure of it. And Machiavelli said, do all your evil at once, and then spin the good out. People will then forget the evil you did, or the bad, and they'll remember, all they remember will be these goods that came in over a period of years. But, I mean, this was expenditures for education, roads, welfare, etc. I think it moved the state along and it was good.
How about McKibben?
Where are you going to see McKibben, by the way?
Saturday.
Where?
At his house.
In Columbia, yeah. He's a fascinating guy. He's a great storyteller. In fact, if you don't watch him, he'll get you sidetracked telling you stories that you'll roar at. and talk, he's very conceited. And I used to talk to John, and he would tell me about the Battle of Chancellorsville. He said, of course, he said, I know you know about this, but let me tell you my idea. he's got one wonderful story about Earl Long saying he didn't have to talk to colored audiences. That's what McKibben was, public commissioner, service commissioner. Earl was telling some people in the mansion he didn't have to talk to colored audiences. He said, I got me the best nigger speaker in the state, John McKibben. I like McKibben very much personally. And McKibben was a... Am I taking up your time without giving you anything very valuable? McKibben would... he'd get a sudden liking for somebody. And his associates could never figure out why he was there. Usually they couldn't figure out why, but if he liked you, that was it. And I know for some reason he got a liking for me. He came to visit my class, for example, and was very, very nice to me in various ways when I was briefly on the Bicentennial Commission, and which he appointed me chairman without telling me he was going to do it. And I got off it eventually, but he was very helpful to me there. And a man in Sanger likes to read history. Most of it's about the Civil War that he read on the Confederate side, but he does like history. But I would say John McKethan, I'd say this true of Edwin Edwards. I think they're both aware, you know, that Louisiana and the South is living in the 20th century in the modern world. And I'm not sure Jimmy Davis was aware of this. You know, it's a new day after all. And there are certain things politicians now have to do. And I think John knew that, and I'm very sure Edwards knows this. You know, you just don't go around saying and doing the old things you used to do. And I think you see it in the last race, in Jimmy Davis's race. I was talking to Ed Stagg after the election. You know Ed Stagg? He's cable counsel for a better Louisiana. You might talk to him. He's a very interesting guy. And Ed Stagg. And I said I was surprised at the low vote Jimmy Davis got. In fact, I was afraid he'd be in the second primary. And Ed said he wasn't surprised, and because he said he had taken the tabulation of the vote Jimmy Davis got in 1960, and he said he figured it would be no more than that, maybe less, because it was an older vote, and a lot of these people had died who voted for Jimmy in 1960. And of course, he was absolutely right. I would suspect Jimmy Davis got practically no votes from young voters. But Jimmy Davis never emerged into the 20th century, I don't think.
What do you think, how do you account for the collapse of resistance to integration after it came?
Well, you know, I discuss it in here, and without accounting for it, probably. How far did you get in the article? Did you get to where I quoted Leslie Dunbar? He said, you know, the white Southerner made his fight and he lost it. So what? He adjusted to it then. But it is an almost miraculous change.
As a historian, did that surprise you?
Yeah. Yeah. And please me. Yes, I think it did surprise me, yeah, yeah. But once the fight was lost, that was it. I mean, God, you get George Wallace emerging today almost as a hero to blacks. Great moderate on the racial issue now. Jesus.
What's the future say for John Rary?
None, I hope. John Rarick is... Well, he's a doctrinaire, I think. I don't know how he gets elected in a district like this. Extreme reactionary. Truly, I think, a man who doesn't live in the 20th century. Incidentally, he's from Indiana, you know.
Yeah, Southern Indiana.
Huh? Southern. Well, I don't know what part of Indiana he is, but he was originally from Indiana, you know. Came down to the Feliciana parishes after the war, I guess. But, well, I wouldn't think he'd ever go anywhere. In fact, he'd be fortunate to hold on to his congressional seat. But I would say probably John Rarick gets elected, as some people still do, by appealing to the politics of frustration. You know, you hate Washington and those bastards up there, and here's a guy who gives them hell, and so you elect somebody like John Rarick, and you're making a face. At the national government.
What's your explanation of Russell Long's almost leadership role in opposing the family assistance program, which to me at least was the nearest thing to a national share the wealth concept there ever was?
Yeah. Well, Russell, different generation, different mold than his father, from his father. Russell, conservative, except on certain areas, they're partly a survival from his father, I think. You'd say, at least for the small businessman, or for the little businessman, the little guy. And I think Russell voted for the abolition of the poll tax, too. But Russell is just a conservative. And I'm sure he doesn't like some of the things I say about his father being a radical. But,
so his role came as no surprise to
him? No.
I go back to that.